Yankees Files podcast. We are back. I'm Will Harris, you're Alec Whipple, and the rest of you are fans of a baseball team that just acquired another top five hitter in the game to go along with their former MVP, Aaron Judge. Whipple, it's the holiday season. Things are good in Yankee land, as much as people may think that they're not because they lost their shiny new toy. How are you doing?
I think that we shouldn't let the timing of the pod overshadow how freaking awesome it is to have Juan Soto on the Yankees. I mean, we haven't recorded in a few weeks, but I think the last few weeks have been kind of the highs and the lows that we're used to. But I don't get the sense that, you know, the lows of this offseason are quite the same as they would be otherwise. And that's partially because you can't be all that upset at the end of the offseason if, like you said, you acquire one of the best five hitters in baseball. And make no mistake, I'm sure we will read plenty of takes in the next 9 months about Juan Soto doesn't run well. Juan Soto doesn't play good defense. He doesn't hustle. You know, he goes through one slump. It's not worth it. He's overpaid. Make no mistake, this guy is going to be, will be, you know, for the foreseeable future, one of the best players in baseball. I mean, when you are, you know, rocking a career low of 140 WRC plus, you know, in your worst season, you've never had below a 400 on base percentage, 500 slugging. I mean, you're 25 and you already are in kind of Hall of Fame territory with your career accomplishments. And you know, you're now playing for the New York Yankees. And I just think we should not let what's happened in the last 48 hours overshadow just how impactful this is. And anything, I mean, now that Juan Soto is a Yankee, and you could tell me if you agree, I think it's fair to say anything short of Juan Soto would have made this offseason a failure. And now that Juan Soto is a Yankee, it doesn't really matter. I mean, obviously other things need to happen, but I don't think any of us are as concerned about what specifically happens the rest of the offseason for it to be deemed a success. And that seems like an exaggeration, but I mean, it's Juan Soto. Like, I don't know what else you say.
Soto. He's really good and all.
Yeah, this is not a good player. This is not a great player. This is a transcendent player. And it has been a long, long time since the Yankees have acquired one of those on the offensive side.
Yeah, I mean, you can't almost say enough about what a huge move this is for the Yankees. The thing that I keep going back to is, in 2023, the Yankees got 14.7 Fangraphs WAR from batters. And in 2024, Steamer projects the Yankees to get 13 Fangraphs WAR from just Juan Soto and Aaron Judge, which, you know, obviously they got to stay healthy. But that's something Soto has tended to do well in his career. Again, with Judge, it's really been freak injuries that have hurt him. So there ought not be something systematic that holds those two out for extended periods of time, as long as they don't get really bad breaks and they play to just the guys that we know they're capable of playing to. We're talking about what Steamer currently projects to be the second and third best batters in the sport behind Ronald Acuna. So I gotta say, I'm pretty excited about the Yankees coming into the season with that. I think one direction I want to take this is I really don't think that people grasp how big it is to get Juan Soto. Like, there suddenly, because of one season in which everything that could have gone wrong went wrong, people now believe that the Yankees having Juan Soto and Aaron Judge is like the Angels having Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani. And I think you have to be kind of crazy to believe that. The Yankees last year had almost everything that could have gone wrong go wrong. Gerrit Cole, Gleyber Torres, and like a few arms in the bullpen were the only players who were any good, really.
And Aaron Judge.
And Aaron Judge, but he missed months from kicking a wall. Like, so that definitely falls in the going wrong camp. He was good when he was healthy, but that, I think, is less of a a relevant point in here because he still had a lot of stuff go wrong. Like, and I know no one wants to hear like, oh, they had a winning record, this, that, whatever. Like, they won 82 games. They were not a million games out of a playoff spot. The Yankees bottoming out was still better than many, many teams in Major League Baseball. And then they added a top five hitter in the sport, potentially top five player in the sport. I don't know if you want to litigate, all right, you know, this pitcher is this good, this hitter is that good, whatever. But like, Soto is clearly in the Judge, Acuna, Otani, I guess, is out on his own, but he's in that Judge, Acuna, Freeman, Betts, you know, he's in that camp. And to have two of those players, I understand the Dodgers now have three, but that's not what I'm talking about. To have two of those players is really good. And I would argue it's been a long time since the Yankees have had two of those players in their lineup. In 2018, I think they approached it with Judge and Stanton, but the version of Judge we have today is better than the version of Judge that they had then. And that version of Judge, of course, had a freak injury. And then for years, Judge and Stanton weren't healthy at the same time, and now it's a very different Giancarlo Stanton. I think maybe 2009 or, you know, late 2000s, early 2010s, A-Rod and Teixeira were in that direction, but, you know, shortly after he became a Yankee, the shift really started to murder Teixeira, and A-Rod, between injuries and suspensions, wasn't on the field as much. Like, it is exceedingly rare to have two players who are this solidly at the top of the sport hitting back to back in your lineup. And I think people are underestimating what that will do and can do for the Yankees. And by the same token, the Yankees had Luis Severino, Frankie Montas, Carlos Rodon, and Nestor Cortez combined for zero Fangraphs WAR last year. Zero. When people are talking about the dire straits that they perceive the pitching staff to be in, they are not adequately adjusting for the fact that if you took those innings and got four WAR out of them, that would be, first of all, a massive improvement, but second of all, completely a realistic thing to do. So I think people are so focused on how poorly the season went last year, and they are failing to understand fully the magnitude of the upgrades they've made when it comes to Soto and the outfield platoon that we'll get to talking about, but also just the benefits that they stand to gain from average performance from the guys who will be on the team in areas where they were getting negatives last year. And those incremental gains, I think, combined to be much larger than people are giving them credit for.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% agree. And I think, you know, you can argue about whether Stanton or Rizzo or LeMahieu or Rodon or Cortez or whoever you think is the best bet to rebound. And what something like Soto does is effectively, you know, reduce the amount of major rebounds you need to have. And I think people have been frustrated for at least a lot of last year, because so much of the season kind of predicated on, well, if players X, Y, and Z rebound. And again, not completely unrealistic. I mean, there were a lot of factors that kind of combined to take down the Yankees. I don't think it's safe to say, you know, if Anthony Rizzo was, you know, pre-concussion Anthony Rizzo, if Judge didn't get injured, all that stuff. But, and I think they combined to take them down in a way that wasn't just like, you know, everyone played poorly for the whole year. But even if you don't think all of that stuff is bound to come back, I mean, the Yankees effectively hedged in the best way possible by getting the player who single-handedly could transform that lineup and turn a position that was a net negative to them into the best in the league. And like, it's just hard to understate how often you're able, or how rare it is to be able to do that. And it's not like a guarantee that was able to happen. I've seen takes saying, well, Soto fell into their laps and it was a one-year rental. He absolutely not. Like, he did not fall into their laps. What they had to give up to get him was, and I think you'll agree, probably the most chips that Brian Cashman has pushed into the center of the table to go after a guy. Like, they wanted this
easily
guy
too, like, by a fair margin,
right? Four pitchers and Kyle Higashioka, who can't understate Kyle Higashioka, but four pitchers.
But also, like, and not just four pitchers. Four pitchers, three of whom threw good to great innings for the Yankees last year.
Right. It's not a given that the Yankees were just going to give that up to assume salary to do everything they did to get Soto. The impact he's had and that the process that they went through to get him, I think, show how serious they were about upgrading that spot. But also, like, let's just not forget that wasn't a given that they were going to get him. And the effect that he has both in kind of what he can provide to the lineup and what he, the pressure he can take off of others on his own, is, I think, just like, it's just, let's just focus on that and what a big impact it's going to have on the lineup. And on its own, like, again, we don't want to say the Yankees are done, but if the Yankees were somehow to be done, I think, like, it's still a very successful offseason because one guy, it's almost impossible for one guy to have the kind of impact Soto has. And that's exactly what's going to happen because of how good he is. And, like, let's not forget again, like, how kind of a, what a mess the left field spot was for most of the year. It wasn't just they had, you know, Aaron Hicks playing poorly. I mean, they were cycling guys in and out, and that just has a ripple effect. And to have all of those problems solved with one fell swoop, I think, makes the conversation of, is DJ going to rebound? Is Stanton going to rebound? Is Rizzo going to rebound? Just a lot less pressing, a lot less of an important, and I'm sorry if you hear my dog barking in the background.
Your dog, who you should tell the audience, is named...
Is named Scout, but really named Glaber.
Is named Glaber. That's named what I was Glaber. Looking for.
But it, regardless, like, it, the conversation, that conversation takes on a little less importance. And we should talk about what pitching upgrades the Yankees can make, but I think everything you've said about Rodon and Cortez is spot on in that they don't have to rebound to Cy Young levels for them to help the Yankees in a meaningful way next year. And it's not crazy to think that guys, at least in Rodon's case, guys with a track record of success who didn't have a diminishment in stuff last year, who were missing time with injuries and not necessarily pitching poorly for 6 months of the year, it's not crazy to think they could rebound and be at least, I mean, if you want to be skeptical, I think it's safe to say two war guys, three war guys. The ceiling's, I mean, a lot higher, but that's the reality.
Here's what I wanted to talk about with Rodon. People have decided, including one Twitter user in particular, that Steamer is just a bunch of crap and that Carlos Rodon is going to be bad forever now. Here are the major league starting pitchers projected to be worth between 3.1 and 3.3 Fangraphs WAR, according to Steamer in 2024. Justin Steele, Jesus Luzardo, Kodai Senga, Freddie Peralta, Blake Snell, who we'll recall just won the Cy Young, Jordan Montgomery, who has become the white whale of many Yankees fans, Carlos Rodon, and Sonny Gray. That is the company that Carlos Rodon is keeping. And you might say, well, you shouldn't be paying $27.5 million for that guy. You might say, well, those guys are all coming off stronger years than Rodon is. You might say a lot of things. But the bottom line is, if you are pounding the table for Jordan Montgomery because you think Carlos Rodon's rotation spot is so tenuous and you're so concerned about, you know, whether he can even pitch competently again, I have a little bit of trouble taking you seriously. Like, projections are not the be-all end-all. Projection systems are imperfect. We see that year after year. But on average, they do a pretty darn good job. So when they are telling us, here is the company that Carlos Rodon is keeping among other pitchers, and you say, well, we should go out and give 6 years and $180 million or whatever it would end up being, probably something on the order of that, to Jordan Montgomery. Like, I guess you can have that opinion, but if the logic behind it is, well, Carlos Rodon is cooked and we need to give that money to a pitcher who I don't think is cooked, I have some doubts. Like, the idea that Jordan Montgomery could go out for a few more years and produce three WAR a year, which is a valuable thing to do for a pitcher, a very valuable thing to do. Like, that's not crazy to me. It's not. But the idea that Jordan Montgomery like that you completely discount what Carlos Rodon could be to this rotation. You say Carlos Rodon is nothing, and then you add Jordan Montgomery to it and you go, hey, now we're talking. No, if you're discounting Carlos Rodon entirely and you're just putting in Jordan Montgomery, that's a replacement. That's not an improvement necessarily. And yeah, so that I think people are correct to say that the Yankees ought to add pitching. I think that is true. I think people are wrong about the presumed dire straits that the pitching is in. I think basically everyone agrees that the Yankees are going to end up with Frankie Montas. So when you talk about the Montas, Rodon, Cortez rotation spots, which could be 2-3-4, 3-4-5, 2-3-5, whatever it ends up being. In the absence of any other acquisitions, first of all, you're still talking about a projected like 7 WAR or something. And I would be okay with that. Like I'd like them to do more, but it doesn't like bother me. And people are ignoring what an improvement that is over the 0.6 WAR that they got. So like, even if we ignore Montas, Rodon and Cortez last year, I'm pretty sure were worth 0.6 Fangraphs WAR together. Mm-hmm. They're projected to be worth 5 in 2024. That is a massive improvement. And then you add on another productive rotation spot on top of that, whether it's Frankie Montas and Lucas Giolito together. And I'm sorry if you're hearing the Lucas Giolito to the Yankees connection here for the first time. I'm not guaranteeing anything. I'm just telling you what I'm hearing. And I don't love it either. But if Lucas Giolito can eat innings at a 4.2 ERA, which I think he's more than capable of doing, that's a valuable guy to have at the back of your rotation. And then, look, so I'm going to say something. People are going to disagree because, as always, I'm not being, you know, doom and gloom enough about the state of the Yankees. If the Yankees go into 2022, what year is it? Holy cow. Andre Dawson walking out of the Ivy. You remember that commercial?
Yep. We're still in the lockout. I can't believe we forgot. Yeah. Dark That's crazy. Days. Yeah, if you think this offseason is bad, just be thankful it's not 2 years ago, because
yeah,
at this point I think we were like ready to kill each other.
Congratulations to the Braves on winning the World Series. If the Yankees go into 2024 and they have Gerrit Cole, Nestor Cortez, Carlos Rodon, Clark Schmidt, Frankie Montas, and Lucas Giolito, or someone's who are like Frankie Montas and Lucas Giolito, and that group is supplemented by Luis Gil, who it looks like should be healthy for the spring, Chase Hampton, Will Warren, Clayton Beter, to the extent that those guys project to eat innings at different rates in the major leagues, and you know they're used optimally, whether it's in the Mike King role or single inning reliever roles or starter roles, whatever it ends up being. And the Yankees are equipped to make a deal at the trade deadline for the kind of, you know, starter du jour. It's not obvious to me that that's a bad situation to be in. Like, yes, the rotation ceiling is not as high as it might have been otherwise, but like, you're talking about guys who could pitch serviceably or well, hold down a rotation, and with the quality of bullpen that the Yankees always have, put this team in a position to win a ton of games, especially since they're going to score a ton more runs this year. Like, I can very easily talk myself into this being a good regular season team. And then you just figure out around the deadline what you have to do to, you know, bring your strongest possible rotation into the playoffs. But at that point, you've gotten to evaluate what you're getting from each of these guys for a while. So yeah. I could be pretty excited about that.
No, I think it, and I agree. I think it comes down. So I guess trying to think of the best way for it. One, well, one, I don't believe that Carlos Rodon is done as an effective pitcher as many people do. But like,
yeah,
I think your point and the point that we've been trying to make and we're dancing around is that the fix for this offense needed to be a lot more drastic than the fix for this pitching staff. And the stat du jour that I've seen is that, you know, the Yankees were 20th in F4 from batters and 20th from pitchers, and, you know, or without Gerrit Cole. So, you know, essentially people are arguing the fix for the rotation needs to be as great as the fix for the offense. But I think the problems that plagued the rotation were not the same that plagued the offense. The offense was plagued by just a lack of depth and guys who could like make an impact outside of Aaron Judge and Gleyber Torres and, you know, maybe Anthony Rizzo pre-concussion. But the rotation was more just like established guys all blew up at the same time and in a spectacular fashion. I mean, like, if you in a grotesque way, like
absolutely really, disgusting,
right? Like Luis Severino, Carlos Rodon, and Nestor Cortez blow up starts like were just really things of awful beauty, and that's like something that
that's this episode title, by the way, things of awful beauty.
Like I think that saying watching, you know, whoever was being run out in the outfield try to hit their way out of a wet paper bag versus like
watch the way you talk about Billy McKinney and Jake Bowers. I don't care what you say about Franchy Cordero, who I did witness hitting what looked to be at the time quite a relevant home run in the Orioles home opener. And I don't care as much what you say about Willie Calhoun, although we know he can bang, but I swear there are three transactions that the Yankees have made this offseason that about which I'm absolutely distraught. And they are, of course, the acquisition of Alex Verdugo and the jettisoning of Jake Bowers and Billy McKinney. And I will not have you slander them on this in this medium, which is supposed to be a safe place for me. I have had enough and I will not hear it from you.
But to be fair, I saw Jake Bowers at a double of Yennier Cano, which was pretty impressive considering like no one could hit him in May.
I'm pretty sure I watched the highlights of that game last night. That was the walk-off sack fly and the Judge home run off Batista. Yeah, that was good.
So, I was impressed by that. Okay, rephrasing it. I think there's a difference between watching the Yankees try to bring in a variety of options to plug holes versus just having your guys blow up. And I think I would rather bet on the rebound for guys who have the established track record, especially for Rodon, where if you look at, you know, fastball velocity was the same. He was having horrific luck with strand rate in terms of home run per fly ball. I mean, the command was probably a function of the injury, but like, you know, stuff that I think he can fix, stuff that I think will regress positively, and just having a full healthy season, assuming that happens. I think Carlos Rodon is a better bet to bounce back to 2021, 2022 than pretty much everyone's giving him credit for. But like, regardless, I think betting on those rebounds, or at least returning to, you know, 50% of what they had in 2022 is just a safer bet and a better option to supplement, you know, with the kind of pitchers you're talking about, versus what had to happen to the offense. And Brian Cashman knew that because they approached this offseason in a very specific and targeted way, where first they plug the outfield holes, then they go after the pitching, knowing what's on the market, but also knowing what his team needed more.
Yep.
And this is a safe space to talk about Brian Cashman praise, also give him criticism. But I think this offseason really deserves nothing but praise because, as I texted you a few weeks ago, what he had to do to get the Soto deal done was both out of his comfort zone and something that I think only a GM of 20 to 25 years could have the experience to pull off. And what happened with Yamamoto was not the Yankees saying, well, we don't need pitching because this is going to cost us a little more.
Yeah. We got to talk about Yamamoto.
Yeah. We can talk about Yamamoto, but just returning to the overall rotation, it's knowing your strength. It's knowing what's the better bet to rebound. And it's just approaching that with, you know, they hold the cards, even though they traded away four pitchers, they hold the cards. And I think Carlos Rodon and Nestor Cortez, at least the likelihood of them rebounding to an acceptable level, is a huge reason why. And I'm sorry for the slander. I apologize.
Yeah, you're on a roll this morning, except for the part where you tried to act like Jake Bowers and Billy McKinney aren't going to be top 10 MVP vote getters next year. You've been doing great. So, and I think you're right about the assessment of the offseason thus far. the Yankees needed to shore up the outfield, especially when it became clear that Oswaldo Cabrera, for whom it would have been a miracle if he had developed into a long-term option, especially when it became clear that he was not an option with Aaron Hicks cratering and then the hedges being, well, we accelerate Jason Dominguez really fast through the minors and he shows up and seems like he can be an answer, of course, gets hurt. Okay, well, we got, you know, Franchi Cordero out there and we got Willie Calhoun and we got Jake Bowers and we got Billy McKinney and we'll ride the hot hand until we can't anymore. It showed them a need to hedge more effectively with more reliable players earlier. And they did that.
And exactly your point is proved by Trent Grisham. I think Trent Grisham is the embodiment of what you're saying.
Exactly. So Trent Grisham is the perfect lottery ticket, in my opinion. Trent Grisham is going to play an elite center field, whether he mashes or whether he is Harrison Bader at the plate. That is the first thing. So your floor there is Harrison Bader. But it gets better because Trent Grisham is never... like he's not your everyday option. He is naturally part of a platoon. He's gonna mash lefties. So whenever there's a lefty on the mound, you put Grisham in center field, you get Aaron Judge out of center field, and you have another guy in the lineup who's gonna mash against lefties. That's great. If you end up in a situation where you need to play Trent Grisham more often and he hits righties, it's all gravy. But this is a guy who can put up a WRC plus around, what, 115, 120 against lefties, which is awesome, and play better center field defense than almost anyone in Major League Baseball. That is a great guy to have, and he's going to have a sick mustache. I am going to love Trent Grisham. But then, furthermore, it's quite clear that I'm not enamored with Alex Verdugo as a baseball player. In fact, Alex Verdugo... it was, what, twice in 16 months that the Yankees traded for a really terrible corner outfielder formerly of the Boston Red Sox, who I hate, you know, between Benintendi and Verdugo. And I think if you had to play Alex Verdugo every day against pitchers of both handednesses and you... we're relying on him to be an impact bat in the lineup, you'd be disappointed. But Alex Verdugo in a platoon role, if you find his niche in the outfield, whether it's, all right, you know, at home he plays right, on the road he plays left, or whatever it ends up being, or at home he plays left, on the road he plays right, what, however it works, I think there's a way to optimize Alex Verdugo. I don't think it's crazy to think that. And I think you're exactly right that the way Cashman approached this offseason in getting those bats and supplementing both the lineup and filling in the question mark spots that existed on the position player side of the roster, I think the Yankees did great there, and Brian Cashman deserves a lot of credit. Something for which Brian Cashman does not deserve criticism is the handling, and neither does Hal Steinbrenner, to be clear, it's the handling of the Yamamoto situation. So, in case there's anyone who's listening who's not super well acquainted with this, Yoshinobu Yamamoto is a 25-year-old pitcher coming over from Japan who just signed a 12-year, $325 million contract with the Los Angeles Dodgers. So weird that he'd end up on the Dodgers. That is, in terms of guaranteed money, we'll see, given opt-outs and stuff, what ultimately gets paid to him by the Dodgers. But that is the richest total pitching contract ever given out in Major League Baseball history, until Gerrit Cole opts out and the Yankees tack a year on, and then he once again has the richest pitching contract in Major League Baseball history. Anyway, the Yankees offered Yamamoto 10 years and $300 million. That is a higher average annual value than what the Dodgers offered. And their contract as far as we know, was not as heavily backloaded as the Dodgers contract. So to get the bulk of the money from the Dodgers, Yamamoto will have to elect not to opt out and go hit free agency again. And the Yankees offered earlier opt-outs. So from an annual average value perspective, from a present value perspective, and from an expected value perspective of hitting free agency earlier with an opportunity to get paid again, the Yankees probably offered the better deal. And we got some responses on Twitter about how if the Yankees are willing to do 10 for 300, why wouldn't they do 12 for 360? Well, if you think about it in terms of guaranteed money, think about going into your boss's office and saying, hey, you have some idea of how long I'm going to work here. And you have some idea of what I'm going to get paid over that period of time. Take that pay number and just jack it up 20%. Like that's not a small thing. The tacking $60 million onto a contract during a period when the player is almost guaranteed to be bad is questionable. And it's definitely not just something you can wave your hand at and go, oh, that's the same. It's not. And a lot of people on Twitter have been misinterpreting this as me like worrying about the wallet of a billionaire or something, which I think if you know my track record is not something I do. You have to be able to justify the moves you are making. And going out and paying $30 million a year to a guy who, I'll be honest, probably isn't an ace in Major League Baseball. Like, I see Yamamoto as like a, I don't know, 3.6 to 3.8 ERA guy. We know guys coming over from Japan do not always throw a crap ton of innings. Shout out Hideo Nomo, though, because he did. Like, this is not Gerrit Cole. And there were a lot of demands from Yankee fans to give him Gerrit Cole money. And I think that partially speaks to the scarcity of the market. But, like, I got to be honest, it's not looking after Hal Steinbrenner's wallet to say that the Yankees should want to give out good deals for good players, or deals that make sense for good players. I'm not asking them to operate like the Braves and completely exploit every player who they have, but the Yankees ought to have a sense of what they're willing to pay for a player. And if the demand to get Yamamoto, who I think it's becoming clearer and clearer, was always going to pick the Dodgers no matter what, if the demand to get him was to make him the highest paid pitcher in Major League Baseball over more than a decade, I don't think that fits the player. In the same way, like, I don't think someone should give Jordan Montgomery, who's entering his age 31 season, like 8 years and $240 million. I don't think someone will, but like, you're talking about something on the order of that. Like, if Yamamoto never has a 5-WAR season, that will not be surprising. And to sign up to pay that guy the $360 million that a lot of Yankees fans wanted the Yankees to sign up to pay him, it doesn't add up to me. And I think as long as the Yankees make a good faith effort to spend the money that they were willing to spend on Yamamoto, or spend other resources in kind that, you know, are comparable to that money to improve the team in relevant ways, then I think they could arguably come out ahead. Like, you got to have a limit. Otherwise, why shouldn't they have offered him $500 million? Like, I struggle with a lot of the arguments of like, you know, oh, they needed him and I can't believe Hal is so cheap. Like, come on. The same people who are saying Hal's cheap are the people who the first time he gives up 5 runs in a start are going to say he's a bust. I can't believe we're paying this guy. He never pitched anything in Major League Baseball. You can't win.
Yeah, I mean, everything you said assumes that the Yankees even had a chance to raise their offer to that.
Exactly.
Point.
Yeah. No, as I've said to people on Twitter, like, it's entirely possible that Yamamoto's agent said, give me a sealed bid.
Right. Well,
make your best offer. or that he was only going to allow the Dodgers to match or whatever it might have been.
Right. We know that there were, of the two teams that were bidding on him at that level that were not the Dodgers, our sample size of two teams, we know that one of them gave an offer at which was matched and they did not have a chance to raise. So why am I to believe that the Yankees were not able to make that say, or why do I believe that the Yankees were any different than the Mets, where he was clearly giving priority to the Dodgers? The Yankees gave him things that were objectively better, and you cannot say that they were identical, you know, things to prefer about the deal, because objectively the Yankees gave him a chance to get back in the market earlier, like you said, more guaranteed money up front, like you said. We don't even know how backloaded the deal is, and
more honestly, money per year.
After what we've seen with Ohtani, I know the money's not deferred, but I would not be surprised if it was heavily, heavily backloaded, or at least.
And the rumors are it is substantially backloaded. Yeah, you're right. Exactly right. So, and this gets into if George were alive. So right. We've seen a number of if George were alive, Yamamoto would be on the Yankees takes. And there are two problems with that. The first, you already identified. The only other team that offered him $325 million was not given a chance to sweeten that offer after the Dodgers matched it.
Right. Modern day George Steinbrenner, as many are calling Steve Cohen. Exactly. Not ever to get this player. So,
second, people have this warped sense of who George Steinbrenner was. George Steinbrenner whiffed on quality free agents for ridiculous reasons many times. Don't you think, like, if George Steinbrenner had died in 2001, we would have had a million takes about if George were alive, Vlad Guerrero would have been a Yankee, and if George were alive, Carlos Beltran would have been a Yankee, and if George were alive, Johan Santana would have been a Yankee. And you know what, Whipple? George was alive when all those guys hit free agency, and none of them ended up on the Yankees. So I don't know where people are getting this narrative. This is the same guy, George Steinbrenner, who throughout the 80s was trading away players for peanuts because he didn't want to pay them. Like, people forget about that, too. This is a ridiculous narrative, and I made a TikTok about this at the beginning of the season. We've talked about it at length at various times. If you think that George Steinbrenner was like locking down every big free agent, frankly, you're insane. And that's just the bottom line. It ends there.
Yeah. I mean, George, the free agency, early free agency, I think, is so different than what modern free agency is that it's not even a comparison. But like, if you look at, you know, semi-modern free agency, I mean, the Yankees only probably more recently than people would acknowledge. And maybe, you know, the 2009 offseason was the one that people point to, which, again, George Steinbrenner was not an active part of the decision making of that of the team at that point.
I think we can be pretty confident George Steinbrenner, in addition to not being an active member in the decision making of the New York Yankees, like, physically and mentally could not have been.
Right. But like, all of the things, you know, the 90s Yankees were really not built on free agent signings, and the ones that people point to in the early 2000s, I mean, if that team was the team that the Yankees were running out today, I think people would be kind of horrified for a lot of reasons.
Yeah,
you know, it's flow does can't play defense, built on home runs, no pitching. I mean, those teams might have won at the time, but like, they were not what people would consider, you know, that the ideal baseball teams, the ones that everyone wants to see. Those were not the teams that, if George was alive, that narrative was building.
Carl Pavano, Jared Wright, cooked Randy Johnson, right. Kenny Lofton, Tony Womack, like, the sum of them were good. Gary Sheffield had two good years with the Yankees. Jason Giambi had a number of very good years with the Yankees. But like, yeah, it's a completely ridiculous narrative. Like, do people forget how many games were started by Aaron Small and Sidney Ponsone and Sean Chacon in these years that we're supposed to believe were so great when George was just out there getting anyone? It's ridiculous.
Right. And the other thing is that the reason that 2009 and something like 2013, again, a Hal Steinbrenner offseason, had to happen is because the farm system wasn't able to support the team at that point. There was no internal reinforcements.
There was no Jason Dominguez. There was, right. Yeah.
no one was trading for a Juan Soto type player because the Yankees did not have the resources to do that. And while 2009 was great, the 2013 offseason, I think, you know, kind of blew up in everyone's face. So like, it's not foolproof. And I think the Yankees, the takeaway is that the Yankees are in so much better of a position. The fact that they have the pieces to trade for Juan Soto without hurting their farm system to a significant extent, the fact that they weren't desperate enough to, you know, need Yamamoto, that they could be negotiating from a position of strength and be able to correctly value the player. Like, all of these things are good things. They're not bad things. That's the takeaway. Like, this is a good offseason, not a bad one.
It is already a good offseason, and I think we can reasonably expect it to get better. So, Whipple, this is a very special episode of Yankees Files. Not only is it the Christmas episode, but it also includes another installment of everyone's favorite segment, Dad Take or Bad Take, with my dad. He's had some gems in the past, whether it's Velcro has failed baseball, whether it was the time that he said basically that he's not proud of me and he'd rather have you be his son. You know, whatever it is.
That was a personal favorite.
Yeah. Whatever it is, there are always some gems. So without further ado, let's get into the latest edition of Dad Take or Bad Take. All right. And we are back with the Christmas edition of Dad Take or Bad Take, featuring once again my dad, Mitch Harris, an esteemed guest on the Yankees Files podcast. As always, Dad, great to have you back on the show. It's been a little while, far too long, some would say. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you for having me. This is terrific. And I just want to start by congratulating you, because I don't think I've appeared on the Yankees Files podcast since you became engaged. So I want to congratulate you on your engagement. And I think you and Whipple will be extremely happy together. So good for you two guys. And we support you.
You're inspiring like some fan fiction or just other rumors. I would say that, luckily for you, the two people who could be most offended by that statement don't listen to the podcast. So
wait a minute. Therese doesn't listen to the podcast?
No, and neither does Morgan, as far as I know.
That's weird.
Yeah. Well, Therese is a Red Sox fan, so I don't think she's exactly within the target audience for this.
This is not the
Red Sox Files.
No, what is it? This is not the target market.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's a Mitch Hedbergism when he says to the audience he's recording a CD and he's like, but of course you will have heard this. This yeah. Is not our target market.
That's a good one. I like every time I'm recording a podcast like this, and instead of having my mic on a stand, I have the cord hanging, I think about when he says pinches the cord and then he lets it go and a bunch of jokes come out. This is the Mitch Hedberg Files podcast.
Yes. Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
Really just Mitch Files, because you're Mitch as well.
Yep.
Yeah. So another thing that happened since we last spoke on this podcast is the Yankees traded for Juan Soto. For the rest of our audience, my biggest regret is telling him which button that was. I might flip up the pages so he can't figure it out again. Anyway, Juan Soto has kind of been your white whale for a little while. I think it's back to 2021 or 2022 that you've been insisting that he ought to be a Yankee. So do you have some reaction to this?
Yes. First reaction is long time in coming. Mm-hmm. They should have done this 2 years ago.
That would have been nice.
Isn't that when he was last traded?
He was traded in the middle of 2022 to the Padres.
Oh, so maybe I'm thinking of his prior... Okay. Seems longer ago than that, but
still
okay.
A year and a half.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, long time, too long in coming. Number one. Number two, credit to the Yankees for doing it and getting it done and actually getting it done pretty quickly, which impressed me. Normally these things drag out and they just got it done. So couldn't be more pleased that he's on the team. Still remains to be seen how he will play in New York. You know, it is crazy, but people come to New York and it's different. And it's certainly a lot different than the West Coast.
It is. Now, this is a guy who we saw at age 20 play very well in the World Series. He had a 132 WRC plus in that postseason. This is also a guy who, and, you know, it's not the most meaningful sample, but this is a guy who's played quite well at Yankee Stadium in his young career. We saw him go yard there off Randy Vasquez when the Padres were in town. He has a 203 WRC plus in his only 28 plate appearances at Yankee Stadium. So, hey, maybe he can play in New York. The bright lights have not hurt him yet.
Yeah, I do think there's a difference between being an opposing player and being a Yankee. But look, I am 110% behind Juan Soto. I think it's a great pickup. It is the pickup that I would have wanted, even more than Mike Trout, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, a 25-year-old who is just as good or better seems to be the better option than the guy who is... here's a fun fact. Mike Trout and Aaron Judge, same age.
Yeah.
that's always funny. So Juan Soto, smashing success, you would say.
I would say.
So that's terrific. When I texted you to inform you that the Yankees got Juan Soto, your response was, and they also got Alex Verdugo.
Yes, which I think you don't like.
I don't like it for a variety of reasons. But this gets us to an interesting question. And there may be a generational component here, so we can explore that. A lot of people insisted throughout this offseason and throughout the prior season, potentially two seasons, that it was really important for the Yankees to have left-handed hitters on their team.
Yes.
And what you'll find is that each of the three hitters the Yankees acquired this offseason thus far, Alex Verdugo, Trent Grisham, and Juan Soto, they're all left-handed.
Yes.
Is this something that was on your mind? Is this something that you were thinking about as you were thinking about the changes you wanted to see the Yankees make, the acquisitions you wanted them to make? Is it something that you remember being a, you know, relevant or important factor? Or were you just, would you have accepted any acquisitions as long as the guys could hit?
So I know you and Whipple talked a little bit about handedness on, maybe it was the last episode of the Yankees Files podcast, but I think it's, personally, I think it's overstated and overblown. I don't know whether the stats actually bear that out.
The stats do bear that out.
And if you look at a guy like, probably, I'll probably leave somebody out, but the last all-time great power hitter, not counting Aaron Judge, that the Yankees had, of course, was A-Rod, who was a right-handed hitter. Aaron Judge is a right-handed hitter.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the great Babe Ruth. Oh, wait a minute.
He wasn't playing in the same stadium, to be fair.
So I think it's fine that they're lefties, and I do think they need balance in their lineup. But it was, I was not obsessed with getting left-handed players.
It's pretty based of you.
Thank you.
Yeah. People on Twitter love to call you based.
I love that.
I'm glad. Okay, so great that they got Juan Soto. Great that they were able to add some stability in the outfield. Great that they were able to add some, you know, potentially valuable platoon bats as well. One thing that you've been underwhelmed with recently is kind of the quality of the Yankees lineup. And I think what we can do here is we can kind of go around the field and talk about who it looks like will be occupying those positions and get your assessment of those guys.
Yes, I love that. And by the way, for the record, I don't know if I said it on a prior appearance on the Yankees Files podcast, but my position is that last year the Yankees sported a four-man lineup And I think you ought to have a nine-man lineup in the game of professional baseball as it's currently played.
So let's, as it's currently played, yeah, things might change. So let's talk about what constitutes a nine-man lineup, because I want to make sure people are clear on your premises here.
Sure. Well, I think that you should put people in your lineup and construct your team with people you actually expect to hit. And I don't think you should include automatic outs. And by the way, baseball is telling us that as baseball has evolved, because the pitcher in the National League in recent times used to be really viewed as kind of an automatic out, and you really had an eight-man lineup. Obviously, that's changed now, and what baseball is saying is you ought to construct your lineup so that it has hitters up and down. And I think I went back, this may not have been on the last episode of the Yankees Files podcast I appeared on, but it may well have. I think I went back and looked at the last great Yankee team and the performance of those players up and down the lineup by WRC+. And that's what I'm... Have I defined that well enough for you?
Yeah, I think one outstanding question, potentially the main outstanding question as we get into this discussion, is when you talk about having a nine-man lineup, are you considering the scarcity of offense at certain positions when you evaluate each player?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the answer is no.
Okay. So in your opinion, your catcher and your first baseman should be expected to be equal offensive players.
No, I mean, I think your catcher and your first baseman should be talented offensive players. I'm not saying they should be as good as some of the other position players at producing offense, but like, I'll give you an example, and I have not gone back and looked at this, so I could be proven wrong by, and as I've said many times on this podcast, if I am wrong, the metaverse will judge me.
And it will.
But you looked at the great Yankees team before the loss of the captain, Thurman Munson. Thurman Munson was a producer at catcher.
He was.
First baseman, Chris Chambliss. Chambliss was a producer at first base. You look at a guy like Mark Teixeira.
Yep,
Mark
sure.
Teixeira, producer at first base. Georgie Posada, producer at catcher. And by the way, I believe we saw him hit a triple.
We did. We saw him hit a triple Fenway at Fenway Park.
Take that, Therese Messina, who isn't listening. So you can have offense at those positions, and I don't like that we kind of default to the idea that those positions.
Well, I think the point with first base is that's a place where defense has almost no value, so offense is much easier to come by. Frequently, you see this with center fielders, you see this with shortstops, and you see this primarily with catchers. There's an offense-defense trade-off. And I've been on record many times on this podcast that I am skeptical often of... I'm skeptical often that the trade-off between offense and defense is being described accurately. But it's certainly the case that a lot of the catchers who are really good at the most important part of catcher defense, which is framing, are also bad hitters. And Jose Trevino, for example, finds a way to be a valuable player without being an effective hitter. And I'm interested in your take on something like that.
So what we've done here is we've hit on one of the many stupid things in baseball. So we value a skill that deceives the umpire into believing that a ball that was not in the strike zone was in the strike zone. That's what we're saying.
Sure.
And we don't need to do that because we have the technology today to not need the umpire to be deceived. And, you know, that's one of baseball's problems. Baseball is all fine with doing other things that sports do, like expanding the playoffs and trying to speed up the game, which I'm all for, by the way. But they can't get this right. And the idea that an umpire has a strike zone is maddening to me. And the idea that we have to put somebody behind the plate who can fool the umpire into thinking a ball is in his strike zone is maddening to me.
I agree with you that framing ought not exist. But is it your contention that teams should not pursue it during this period when it is a valuable part of the game?
No. But my point is just that baseball always manages to get things wrong, or almost always manages to get things wrong. And this is one of the things it gets wrong. And by the way, it can't, as we've seen, discipline umpires who actually don't call the game correctly.
That's true.
It is so backwards. And I know that we believe people who are influential in baseball listen to this podcast. Well, guys, get it together.
Yeah, Rob, come on. Figure it
Jeez.
Out. So let's get back to the conversation about the lineup. I do want to point out that the 1978 World Series winning Yankees gave 415 plate appearances to one Bucky Dent, who produced a 71 WRC plus, but
showed up when it mattered,
was still a valuable player producing 2.5 war because of his phenomenal defense. So this is not exactly a new philosophy. Munson was a below average offensive player that year too, as was Mickey Rivers. What did they all have in common? Good defenders.
Yep. No, I'm not saying that defense isn't important, but what I am saying is that the Yankees in recent years have put,
The Yankees haven't been making that trade-off in every instance where they've been putting bad hitters in the lineup. That's
there you go.
True.
There you go.
This year, fewer trade-offs.
Yeah, I like it.
So let's start in the outfield. Obviously, the top two projected hitters on this New York Yankees team projected to put up a 171 WRC plus and a 158 WRC plus, respectively, Juan Soto and Aaron Judge. I'd say those two certainly qualify as non-automatic outs in this lineup.
So far, two-man lineup. Let's keep going.
Gleyber Torres, coming off one of the stronger offensive seasons by a second baseman in Major League Baseball, projected for a 122 WRC+. He was terrific last year. They have him adding 25 home runs this year. I think pretty strong.
Love it.
He qualifies.
Love it. Three-man.
Okay. Next, we get Anthony Rizzo, projected for a 115 WRC+. Look, he's coming back. So here's what you have to consider with Anthony Rizzo, in my opinion. Anthony Rizzo last year played a lot of games concussed, and that wasn't a good thing. From the beginning of the 2022 season, a season in which Anthony Rizzo played well, to the end of the series against San Diego, the series in which Anthony Rizzo got concussed, he had a 137 WRC+, and that's not a small sample. That's 777 plate appearances. Is it your contention that Anthony Rizzo, if he needs to be the fourth or fifth best hitter in this lineup, can't do so? Because I'm very skeptical of that.
Well, so how many... What's our sample for his post-injury performance?
A little over 2 months. The worst 2 months of his career, but again, we have a very clear explanation as to why it happened. Yeah, 192 plate appearances.
And
so,
what was his WRC plus in that 192 plate appearances?
It was awful. It was like, let's see what it was. 44?
Yeah. And what was it for last year in total?
Last year in total, it was 100. But last 2 years in total, even though he played 2 months with a concussion, which is the only stretch where he was bad, it's 119.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope his mom doesn't listen to this podcast, because if he hadn't gotten a concussion, and maybe that's the reason he couldn't hit, I wanted to give him a concussion.
Oh my gosh.
Is that wrong?
Maybe a little bit.
So Anthony Rizzo, I'm not sold on Anthony Rizzo. So far, we have a 3-man lineup. Let's keep going.
How about Giancarlo Stanton, projected for a 114 WRC+.
Yeah, Mike Stanton is fine, and I'll give it to you. I've seen this guy swing at pitches that he missed by 2 feet, and that always makes me wonder about this guy. But I'll give you Mike. So that's 4 men.
Okay, so that's 4. Let's get down to Alex Verdugo. So Alex Verdugo, you're familiar with Casey Stengel?
I sure am.
Pioneer of the platoon. Alex Verdugo expected to be deployed in a platoon role, only projected, and nobody thinks Alex Verdugo is getting 500 plate appearances for this team. So he's projected for a 107 WRC+ if he gets 500 plate appearances. But last year, against right-handed pitching, which is the situation which we expect him to be used, 115 WRC+ hitter.
Yeah, again, I don't hate the Alex Verdugo pickup nearly as much as you do. I also, and maybe this is not borne out by the stats, think of him as kind of a Yankee killer.
Yes, he is a Yankee killer. And excuse me, that's a 115 WRC+ against right-handed pitching in his career, not just last year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he qualifies?
He qualifies.
Okay.
Is that 5 guys already in this lineup? That's better than last
5
year.
Already. And now we can go to this. This would only count. Maybe Alex Verdugo makes it 4.5, and this guy would make it 5, because he'll be platooned with Trent Grisham. Trent Grisham, who has a 110 career WRC+ against left-handed hitters or left-handed pitchers, and would be doing it playing center field.
Yeah, and I'm not the biggest student of TG, so but I'll give it to you. So we'll say 5. We'll say 5, considering that this is a platoon.
Okay, that brings us to DJ LeMahieu. DJ LeMahieu had a tough year last year, no doubt about it, posting just a 101 WRC+, but I'll give you 2 mitigating factors here for DJ LeMahieu. The first is he had a 118 WRC+ in 2022. The second is in his last 257 plate appearances last year, he had a 129 WRC+. So if you're going to use 190 plate appearances to say Anthony Rizzo will never be good again, it seems like you have to acknowledge these 257 to say there's something there with DJ LeMahieu.
Isn't DJ LeMahieu a career 100 WRC+ hitter?
DJ LeMahieu is a career 102 WRC+ hitter, but since leaving Colorado, he is a career 119 WRC+ hitter, and that's in over 2,600 plate appearances.
Okay, so I'm DJ LeMahieu really disappointed me last year.
Sure.
And he was in 2021?
2019 and 2020. Are you thinking about when he was great?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was great. He was the guy I wanted them to re-sign.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, he hasn't brought it, but he is not an automatic out.
No.
So I'm going to give you DJ LeMahieu.
Okay.
And that gets us 6 players.
We're up to 6 now.
Which is much better than a 4-man lineup. And by the way, if I'm being charitable, last year you might have said a 5-man lineup. So we're already eclipsing 2023.
I think last year you might have said a 2 or 3-man lineup, really. I think it was really just Judge and Glaber for a while there. So we're through 8 guys there. So
really 7.
Yes, yes. 7 spots, 8 players. And now we get to the guys you're not going to like as much, the last 2. We have Anthony Volpe, projected for a 98 WRC+. He was often getting out last year.
Yeah.
He had an on-base percentage under 300. He's projected to have one just over 300. Again, a guy who is going to play good defense, won a gold glove at shortstop, is only going into his age 23 season, but not really the offensive threat as of yet.
What I say to Anthony Volpe is the wolf is at the door for him. Get it? Because his name is...
Yeah, no, I got it.
Okay, I just want to make sure your listeners,
mm-hmm.
the Yankees Files podcast listeners did.
Yeah, it might be more of like a fox thing, because like wolves are often like lupine, you know? Anyway, left-handed side of the catching platoon, Austin Wells. We didn't see a lot of Austin Wells last year, just 75 plate appearances. But here's the thing about Austin Wells. We might have been discussing this the other day. Maybe it wasn't with you. Austin Wells, when he was in the minors, he didn't always think that hitting the ball hard was important.
Yeah, and we did talk about
yeah, this. And he didn't always think that hitting the ball in the air to the pull side was important.
Right.
And then he got to Major League Baseball and he realized that both of those things are important. So he's only projected for a 98 WRC plus, which would be well above the average for catchers in Major League Baseball. But his expected stats, albeit in a small sample last year, suggest that the offensive potential there is actually a lot higher.
Okay. Okay. I can live with that. Who is backing him up?
The other side of that platoon would be Jose Trevino, who is not a good offensive player.
Yeah, but look, I can live with this lineup much more comfortably than last year's lineup. I understand things happen, and maybe my views on Anthony Rizzo fall into the things happen category, but this lineup, I think, is built for success in a way that last year's wasn't. So I'm going to give the Yankees and B Cash good marks on this one. Obviously, we got to see how they perform. And if they don't perform, I expect them to make moves. And one of the things mm-hmm. that they have not done in recent years is make moves when things weren't working.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's possible that this offseason shows a newfound willingness to do that.
Yeah, I guess they have demonstrated a willingness to make moves in the offseason, though. So, we'll see.
So the Yankees lineup that we just discussed, if you look at the 11 players projected to get the most plate appearances, it works out to a 121 WRC plus.
Love it.
Only one team, and it was a team with a historically great offense, exceeded a 121 WRC plus in Major League Baseball last year. So I think there's a lot to be excited
about. I don't know who
that
was. Was it the Dodgers?
It was the Braves.
The Braves, okay. Yeah. What was the Dodgers' WRC plus last year?
116.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I like this. Look, I'm known for being critical sometimes.
So people think about you and they're like, that's a guy who sometimes is critical and other times isn't.
Right.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
That's very unique.
That's what I'm saying. But I'm going to give the Yankees good marks on this.
Love that.
Yeah.
I think there's one more thing you wanted to discuss having to do with playoffs and dynasties and regular seasons and all of that.
Yeah. I think it may fall into one large category, but it might not be one thing. So let me say a few things about baseball, which I think is incredibly poorly run. I think they can't get out of their own way. I think they do stupid things. We talked about the umpires already. And their stupidity knows no bounds, near as I can tell. The expanded playoffs were a mistake.
I want to press you on this.
Go ahead.
Expanded playoffs became a mistake when? When they started playing a league championship series, when they added the first wild card team, when they added the second wild card team, or the most recent expansion?
Well, it's a fair question. And if you really want to be honest about the way baseball works, then it should matter what happens in the regular season. You know, they used to talk about winning the pennant. Nobody talks about winning a pennant anymore. They talk about winning the league championship series because that's the substitute now for the pennant. But winning a pennant used to matter. And if you really wanted to be honest about it, and you've talked about this here on this podcast many times, in a high variance sport, you need lots of games to identify the best team. And you shouldn't have a million playoff series. Query whether even playoff series are the right way to decide the champion in a high variance sport. But in my ideal world, they'd figure out a way, and I don't know if I said this to you, but this was what I was thinking about. They'd figure out a way to make the regular season matter more. And I don't follow the NBA much at all, but they had this in-season tournament. I don't know what the stakes were.
The stakes are just money.
Okay. But I was thinking about this. That's funny that you mentioned that, because I was thinking, why shouldn't you get some massive bonus for having the best record in your league? Like, why shouldn't that be a thing people go out to pursue?
Yeah, as opposed to just getting home field advantage.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and what I'm advocating for, and again, I'm not going to change the playoff structure, or I can't change the playoff structure, and baseball is not going to change the playoff structure. What I'm advocating for is making the regular season matter more. And I think it's an insult to fans who pay an awful lot of money to go to these games when the baseball teams themselves play them like they don't matter.
Will you answer the question, counselor?
I'm sorry. Oh, when did they go wrong?
yeah.
When
did the playoffs get too big?
Well, I think the playoffs got too big when they expanded the playoffs from a single playoff series. But I know that's not realistic, but that is my opinion.
Even though they added a number of teams since then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
But that's my opinion. But the problem that I have is that they've expanded the playoffs, obviously, very substantially. And what that does is grossly devalue the regular season. So It's no surprise that these teams play an individual regular season game like it doesn't matter.
Sure.
Because it doesn't matter. And what they've done is they've created a system where their regular season games that people pay a fortune to go to don't matter. And this is true in other sports, although, as we've pointed out, not in football, in my opinion. You go to that game and then you find out that Aaron Judge isn't playing.
Yeah.
And that's not putting a good product on the field, obviously. But it's all, in my opinion, incentivized by two things. One, the devaluation of the regular season because of the expanded playoffs. And two, the idea that once you get into the playoffs, it's just kind of a crapshoot. And, you know, you guys talked about this on the last podcast as well.
But it's your belief that teams are right to see it as a crapshoot, correct?
Yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah. Yeah, they're responding to a reality that sucks, but something that is the reality.
Right, but it's a reality that they've also created, and baseball has created. And
sure.
And that's why I would love to see it. And I don't know why you couldn't take some money and try to incentivize playing well in the regular season.
Mm-hmm. I would not be against that. I think it would be good for the sport.
So a couple other things that we wanted to talk about. Number one, as critical as I am of baseball, I love the pitch clock. The pitch clock,
which they just shortened with runners on base.
There you go. The pitch clock may actually save baseball, or they're doing things to save baseball with the pitch clock. So I want to commend Major League Baseball for that. I still think it should be shorter.
Okay.
But
it did just get shorter on average, to be clear.
I think the clock with nobody on base should be shorter.
Okay.
And just let me go back to one thing I was saying about going to a game and not seeing Aaron Judge.
Your world.
Thank you.
Aaron Judge may not be the best example for that, just so we're clear.
No, I understand. Yeah. But the idea that you don't always play your best players, and we talked about this the other day, you're not going to a Kansas City Chiefs regular season game and finding out a regular season game if they haven't clinched a playoff berth and finding out that, we're sitting Patrick Mahomes today. We're just going to give him a little rest. Travis Kelce, we're going to sit him down. He's played a bunch of games in a row, and we just got to, we just got to conserve a little bit. So you're going to see some crappy player that doesn't really give him a chance to win. It doesn't happen, and that's because the games matter. You don't play your best players when the games don't matter.
As you know, I have some qualms about this line of thinking, but we don't have to,
okay,
we don't have to get into all of them.
Okay. Yeah. But I'm just putting that out there.
Yep. Yeah. And this is that, you know what? Baseball careers and football careers are exactly the same length too. So that's a great point.
Well, look, I said this to you before. It's no surprise that baseball is not the national pastime anymore. It's no surprise that baseball's popularity has waned drastically.
As you know, I question how much of that you can attribute to the on-field product. I think the NFL has a lot of systematic advantages over baseball, whether it's that every game is nationally televised, whether it's that they only play once a week, whether it's, you know, any number of those things.
Right, but they only play once a week only bolsters my argument that baseball's regular season is too long and the games don't matter. They only play once a week.
No, it's a different thing entirely.
How do you figure?
Baseball and football both are trying, neither as hard as they should, as we've discussed, to play the right length regular season to figure out who the best teams are. And football expanded their playoffs and lengthened their regular season. Baseball lengthened their regular season and then expanded the playoffs multiple times in accordance with adding expansion teams in a number of those cases. Anyway, football is a much lower variance sport than baseball, and football, like hockey, is not a sport that you could ask the players to play that many more games in, which is part of the reason that football, I think, expanded the playoffs. So baseball is, as we've discussed, a very high variance sport. Even in the 162 game, vast number of playoff teams era, we have seen routinely teams come down to the last game of the season. The Yankees made the playoffs in the last game of the season, 2021. Like, that's how long it took to figure out whether the Yankees were a playoff team or not. And I just question, like, you certainly feel like the games aren't important or like the regular season is too long. But as we discussed the other day, when you said you have no idea how long you'd make the season and you have no idea how many playoff teams there should be, this isn't actually a criticism coming from a true analysis of how long the season ought to be based on a number of playoff teams. It's just you saying you think there are too many games.
Well, it's really not. I'm saying I think there are too many games because they play the games like they don't matter. The reason the Yankees had to clinch a playoff berth on the last day of the season was they played a bunch of games where they didn't try.
That it's not clear that that's the case. It is clear that you play games differently based on the understanding that you were evaluated by your performance over 162 of them. But even those individual games that you play or manage differently ought to be part of a larger strategy to optimize your performance over the sample. Like, in the same way that you wouldn't bench your quarterback for one out of 17 NFL games, you wouldn't or two out of 17 NFL games. You wouldn't give Aaron Judge 20 load management days, but if you think it's better for your team to sit Aaron Judge once a month in the middle of a long streak of back-to-back games, that's hardly different than not playing Patrick Mahomes in the fourth quarter of a game because you're up 45-20.
You know what? I'm going to have to say it, and I don't like saying it.
I know what you're going to say.
And I apologize to the kids out there and the families and the grandmas. I apologize to them all. Baseball players are pussies. They're pussies. First of all, and they don't play a hard sport. These guys have to run maybe 90 feet sometimes. Sometimes maybe they run more than that by 60 feet or so. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous how embarrassingly out of shape, not strong, and injury prone these people are. Playing a non-contact sport. And mind you, a sport that historically was played by guys who never worked out, showed up drunk, and didn't do anything in the offseason except another job.
That's true of like every sport.
What, never worked out and showed up drunk?
Yeah.
I don't think...
Have you not seen every Super Bowl before like 35? There are guys smoking cigarettes and drinking beers at halftime. Like, you can find pictures.
I think that's an exaggeration.
You can find a picture of like Phil Simms doing that.
I think that's an exaggeration. But in all seriousness,
not by much.
In all seriousness, these guys play a non-contact sport. Like Mike Stanton was out for how long this season with a mystery injury that he got. Never touching anyone or anything, and maybe he got trying to run partially 90 feet.
Hey, how did you get that pinched nerve in your neck? Did someone like punch you in the neck?
Well, first of all, Mike Stanton is not almost 60 years old.
Yeah, second, but you don't all, show up drunk and not work out. You work out all the time. How did you get a pinched nerve in your neck?
Well, if he had a pinched nerve, I'd give him a pass. So anyway, look, I'm just tired of it. I want these guys to play. God forbid anybody play hurt. God forbid anybody actually get an injury that's discernible. I mean, it's just crazy how fragile these guys are.
Do you think you're going to be okay?
Maybe not. It's embarrassing how fragile these guys when we got guys running into each other at full speed on football fields all the time, and those guys get up and do it again.
I mean, Aaron Judge only missed games last year because he lost a fight with a wall.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not criticizing Aaron
I
Judge,
think walls hit harder than like Troy Polamalu.
What I'm really saying is there are so many mystery injuries that no one can identify, even like how the person got them. And these are just ultra fragile people who play a non-contact sport. I don't get it.
So when Whipple and I wrapped up the podcast, I asked him to rate his confidence out of 10 in the Yankees and to ask Brian Cashman as a proxy for Santa Claus for something under the Yankees' proverbial Christmas tree this Christmas season. I'd like to ask you to do the same.
Does this mean we're wrapping it up?
This does mean we've gone on very long.
Have we? Well, can you cut this down at all?
Well, I don't want to deprive people of Dad Take or Bad Take content.
Okay. Well, then in that case, I'm going to go on confidence level to a 7
okay.
for the New York Yankees. And I know you can't tell me what you and Whipple projected, but I'm gonna say a 7, and I'm gonna say to Brian Cashman and all the Yankees folks who are listening, good job setting up this team for next year. And I'm a hard grader.
You are.
Good job setting up this team for next year. What I would like for Christmas from Brian Cashman, if he could provide this, is I'd like them to bring back Lou Gehrig, the Iron Horse,
oh, no.
who was improbably cut down in his prime by a disease that so coincidentally bore his very same name. So if Bcash could do that for us, I would love to have the Iron Horse back in the lineup.
I don't apologize for him because that would imply that I have some level of responsibility for his being the way that he is. Do you have anything on your wish list from Brian Cashman that doesn't involve raising the dead?
So it's a good question. And one of the things I am not really, and this I think is mostly more Whipple's province than anybody else's, I don't have the best handle on the bullpen.
Sure.
And so I can't say that I know that they need a little help there. I'm worried that they may, but I couldn't identify a relief pitcher. I mean, maybe they could go out and get Jim Catfish Hunter or Raleigh Fingers or somebody like that, but I can't really say.
That's fair. I think there is a general preference for the Yankees to go out and get a relief pitcher. Did you intentionally make sure that the first relief pitcher you named also died of Lou Gehrig's disease?
That just occurred to me as I was saying it.
Oh my gosh.
That just occurred to me as I was saying.
Sure. Yeah.
But he did not die of Jim Catfish Hunter disease, and really that's the—
All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Dad Take or Bad Take. Dad, it was a pleasure and a dubious honor, as always, to have you on the podcast. Any parting shots from you? And I shouldn't let you speak again before we wrap up here.
No. Well, thank you for having me. Congratulations to you and Whipple on embarking on embarking on season four. Congratulations to you and Whipple on a successful season three. Really happy for you guys. Enjoy listening to you and looking forward to the Yankees pitchers and catchers report. What, like February
something.
Something.
Yeah. All right.
So thank you for having me.
Of course. All right. With that, we'll send it back to the rest of the episode. All right, and we are back. Thank you to my dad for joining us once again on the Yankees Files podcast. Thank you to your dad for his personal guarantee that he will join us sometime soon. Doug Whipple, 2024 Comeback Player of the Year. People are talking.
The buzz is in the streets.
The buzz is in the streets. Palpable buzz.
The odds makers are watching.
Exactly. So, Whipple, I think now that we are far enough into the offseason that some big relevant acquisitions have been made, I think it's probably time to wrap this episode up with two things. The first is going to be the return of our confidence ratings, this time in the 2024 New York Yankees. And the second, you know, it's December 23rd today. We'll see how long it takes me to edit this episode and put it on the internet. But we're only a few hours, really, at this point, removed from Santa paying people some visits. And he doesn't seem to have great relationships with Major League Baseball executives. I don't know that there's like a close professional interaction there. But Brian Cashman has been something quite close to Santa Claus this offseason, I would say. He put coal in my stocking with Alex Verdugo, but I was able to open up Juan Soto and Trent Grisham under the tree. I think you should ask Brian Cashman Claus for something as well. So first, your confidence rating, and second, what's on your Cashman Claus wish list?
Well, I always want coal in my stocking because...
Hey!
already thinking of my Gerrit Cole related predictions for next year. But in terms of confidence, I mean, again, I think the message of the pod and of Yankees land right now is that Juan Soto's a Yankee. And that's pretty awesome. Yeah. Like, that's really awesome. It's awesome in a way that probably only the Gerrit Cole transaction has made me feel in the last like decade. I think it's just that impactful in terms of like what it does to the respective part of baseball that, you know, those players are playing, pitching staff, offense. And having Juan Soto and Aaron Judge, I think can cover up, as I said, a lot of things that I might not be as confident about. But regardless, I don't see how you could be anything but extremely confident in the Yankees right now, partially because of Juan Soto, partially because they are doing something we have wanted them to do in terms of getting quality players to act as depth, and in terms of like the Trent Grisham having two really good catchers, etc. And partially because I trust them implicitly to fill out this pitching staff. They've stated a desire to do so, and I don't really have any doubt that the pitchers they bring to camp are going to do well. And, you know, that's not something I could say about the offense without Juan Soto. So I'm going to say, you know, start at a 9 because we haven't seen anything unfold about the season. But like, usually I just feel like my confidence is at more of like, you know, like 8, 7.5 kind of, let's see, let's get to camp. Like, I don't feel that way because the Yankees made a huge statement and I have a hard time believing that 2024 is going to be anything like 2023 when you have Juan Soto in that lineup. So I'm going 9 for confidence. They do need pitchers. I think Cashman Claus, he doesn't need to bring another hitter. Like, I am very happy with the lineup as it stands. But for who I'd like to see in my stocking, I'd like Shane Bieber to be a Yankee. I know there are some red flags. I know there's an injury risk. I know, you know, maybe his stuff isn't where it used to be. But
you have Bieber fever.
I have Bieber fever. That might be affected by me seeing him pitch in the 2022 playoffs and pitch really well. And you know, much as Cliff Lee did to me many moons ago, that does leave an impression on my heart. But I feel like Bieber, for the cost that it might take to acquire him for a year, is just a guy that I think is due for a bit of a rebound, but also one that I would trust to fill out the middle of the staff. And if you have, you know, Rodon, Bieber, and Cortez all betting on for rebounds, like, I feel confident in that group to pitch much better than they did this last season. I want to add guys who at least have high floors, maybe not the upside of a Yamamoto, but I feel like Bieber is that guy where I could squint and see the upside. And I'd rather
he is that driveline this offseason.
We, as you said, everyone should be at driveline. Bieber's only following your advice. Yep. So I want to pair Bieber with Matt Blake. I want to see the 2020 Cy Young winner in a Yankees uniform. And at the very least, we know when the Yankees acquire former Cleveland Cy Young winners, they usually receive positive benefits. Corey Kluber's no-hitter and his teachings to Mike King. You know, without Corey Kluber, we don't know if Juan Soto would be a Yankee. So maybe Shane Bieber will have the impact in that way. But regardless, I feel like I'm settling on him as kind of the best combination in terms of what you can get out of him and what he would cost to acquire. So let's make it happen. Let's bring Shane to the Bronx.
I love it. My blind faith in driveline is guiding me more than my trepidation about Bieber's expected numbers from 2023, but sure, why not? It's all good vibes on this Christmas episode of Yankees Files. As far as confidence, I think I got to be at an 8. I'm confident that they will address the pitching staff, but I want to reserve some judgment until I see how they do so. But you're exactly right. The moves that they've already made are so good, and I think we can expect that they're going to score a lot more runs this year. If they are similar or even a little better at run prevention than they were in 2023, like, we could see some very good stuff happen. As far as what I'm asking for from Cashman Claus, it's tough, man. But I continue to find myself kind of enamored with the Marlins rotation. And, you know, it's clear that not everyone in that rotation is available. We've heard rumors about talks about Jesus Luzardo with various teams. Like, he's a name that gets thrown around a lot. And we've heard, or, you know, we wouldn't expect that a guy like Yuri Perez would be available. I don't even think Braxton Garrett would be, even though he's younger. He just has so many years of control and people are really excited about him. A guy with years of control who's a little tougher to manage, though, from a Marlins perspective, is Edward Cabrera. We've seen him pitch in parts of two seasons in the majors, and he was really exciting in 2022. And then definitely not in 2023, but he strikes out a lot of guys. If the Yankees could figure out how to get his walks down, he could be a really interesting guy for them to have. And I kind of love him as like a vibes guy and a project. So because I'm confident that they'll address the rotation elsewhere, bring me Edward Cabrera. I'd love to find Edward Cabrera in my stocking in a couple days here. Whipple, yeah. That wraps it up. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say,
I won't finish the year by cutting you off.
I was going to say, much as I trust the Yankees with pitching, I think the Marlins are another team where I'd implicitly trust their pitching development. So yeah. I'm all for whoever, you know, if they want to go that route. I think at this point in my baseball watching career, like, I feel like I just trust teams and I want to like mine those teams. So Cleveland, Miami, like both end that list.
Yeah. Any pitcher you get from there, you can feel pretty confident in. Mike King came from Miami, did he not?
He did.
There you go.
Shout out Nate Eovaldi trade.
Shout out Nate Eovaldi trade. And congratulations on winning the World Series, Nate Eovaldi. Whipple, as we wrap up 2023 on Yankees Files, I think we can say it's been a really exciting year. You know, we did some of the wrap up at the end of the regular season as we're really in our 2024 season. But we hit 3,000 followers on Twitter the other day. Thank you to everyone who's following us over there. If you're not following us, please do. And look, man, it's going to be an exciting 2024 for us and for the New York Yankees. And I'm glad that everyone with us is along for the ride. And I hope a bunch of people jump on as we go.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's been a great year, but I think I'm excited to get back to, you know, talking about a really good baseball team. So I look forward to seeing what next year has in store. I also just remembered that Mike King was not in the Nate Eovaldi trade and I had to fact check myself to avoid going out on a low note. But it was the Marlins with, it was the Caleb Smith, Garrett Cooper trade. So,
oh, even better.
Yeah. So you know what? We always strive for factual accuracy and I just couldn't let that be how 2023 ended. So, shout out to fact checking yourself.
Shout out to fact checking yourself and shout out to Garrett Cooper and Caleb Smith, just cause. With that, we will wrap things up. Thank you all for listening to Yankees Files in 2023. We will see you again in 2024. And until then, let's go Yankees.